You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
All right, well, good morning. We are in the middle of a series that focuses on the book of Proverbs, right? And as Sean stated during week one, a proverb is simply a true-to-life statement. It's an observation. It describes the way that things are. And in the book of Proverbs that we find in the Bible, these statements are guidelines for wise or godly living, okay? Now, some of these guidelines focus on money and finances, and this is exactly what we're going to talk about this morning. And talking about money is never easy. I'm going to give you that from the start. And at MC3, we don't talk a whole lot about money. Actually, the last time we really delved into it was way back in, I think, 2013, when we had a series called Funds. But talking about money in church is really important. Why? Well, some sources estimate that in the Bible, the writers talk over 2,000 verses about money or matters related to money. Now, some other sources say it's not that many, that maybe it's only several hundred, and I was going to count them all for you, but truthfully, ran out of time. This past couple weeks have been crazy. If someone wants to go home and do that for me, just let me know next week. I'll appreciate that. But whether it's a couple hundred or a couple thousand, either way, the writers of the Bible thought that money was important to talk about. And because they thought that, I think we should think that too. Now, to start things off this morning, we're going to start off with a pop quiz, because everybody loves pop quizzes, right? Just relax. It's only five questions. It's going to be multiple choice. That's really the best kind of pop quiz, right? And you're going to have the same five answers for each of the questions. Okay, so keep track of your answers somewhere. I don't have a fancy polling thingamajig. I don't have time for that, and it could go wrong and all that stuff. So just kind of keep track in your mind or on your cell phone, whatever you want to do. We're going to put the answers up on the screen. Go ahead and do that. There's your answers. You can see them all, A through E. Here are your questions. Number one. What percentage of Americans maintain a household budget? Pick one of those answers. We're going fast here. Question number two. What percentage of American churchgoers give 10% of their income to their church? One of those answers. Question number three. What percentage of Americans have less than $1,000 in their bank accounts? Number four. What percentage of Americans say they've wasted a considerable amount of money in their lifetime? And question number five, what percentage of Americans are in debt? Now, by the end of the morning, you're going to know the answers to each of those questions, and I'm going to warn you that the answers are pretty discouraging. But you're also going to know some biblical guidelines provided through the book of Proverbs and elsewhere on how we can rethink money. And that's what we're talking about this morning. It's titled, Wise Up and Rethink Money. Now, I have two quick disclaimers here before we begin. One, please don't get overwhelmed. When we learn the high standards that God calls us to regarding money or our finances, we're going to realize that there are probably multiple areas where we're all falling short. There's going to be multiple areas where you realize that maybe you need to improve. And we should all want to work towards meeting those high standards. But I don't think we can accomplish them all at one time. It's going to be making small changes a little bit at a time in order to change our mindset and to change our habits. And I'm going to consider it a win if you take something from my message today and you implement it in how you rethink money. The second disclaimer. Please don't think that just because I'm up here talking about money, that I somehow have mastered all these financial ideals that we're going to talk about. I do think that Steph and I are pretty grounded when it comes to money, and we do try to live out a lot of what we're going to talk about this morning, but by no means do we have it all figured out. We certainly have areas for improvement as well. Okay? Here we go. The first part of rethinking money is to strategize. It's to make a plan. And the first part of making a plan is to ask ourselves why. Why do we need to strategize? Why do we need to make a plan? You know, in baseball, strategizing involves deciding on your lineup, deciding on your starting pitcher, who's going to bat where. Why do they do this? Well, to try to win the game. That's their why. Companies strategize. They decide on their marketing techniques. They work on their guidelines for customer service. Why? Well, because they want to sell more products. They want to earn more profits. That's their why. As Christ followers, when it comes to creating a strategy on how to approach money, we also have to have an answer to why. In other words, why should we bother? Why should we have a plan for money? And here's the answer. And if this isn't your answer, it needs to be your answer, because there really isn't an alternative. Because we need to strategize. We need to have a plan, because we wholeheartedly believe that God owns everything, including our money. Notice the quotes, our money. And that we are called to manage it in ways that honor Him. That's the why. God owns it. We manage it so it can honor Him. Now, we see this concept early on in the Old Testament in the book of Leviticus. God was giving instructions to the people of Israel about the promised land, the land of Canaan. That was the land that they were about to enter into. And we see in chapter 25, verse 23, it says this: "The land must never be sold on a permanent basis, for the land belongs to me." This is God speaking. You Israelite people, are only foreigners and tenant farmers working for me. So basically, God was telling the people that they weren't going to own the land or anything in it. It was all going to be owned by God. The people were simply going to be the tenant farmers. They would be residents on someone else's property. They would be using the resources of someone else's land. They were the caretakers. They were the managers. They used the land, but they didn't own the land. It was God's. And today, despite what we all might think, we don't own anything. We don't own our house. We don't own our car. We don't own the money in our bank accounts. Now, the world says we own it, and we may think we own it. But in reality, everything is owned by God. It always has been. It always will be. We came into the world with nothing. We're going to leave the world with nothing. And while we are here, we are simply the tenant farmers, or the managers, or even a better word, stewards of what God has given us. And as stewards, we should strive to steward to the best of our ability. So we need a plan. We need that strategy. We need that batting lineup. We need that marketing technique on how to accomplish the why. And it doesn't matter if you have a little bit or a lot. It doesn't matter if you have $100 or $100,000. It doesn't matter if you're a student or you work part-time, you work full-time, you're retired, you stay at home. If you have any amount of money to your name, you need a plan for it. And that brings us to our first proverb of the morning. In chapter 27, verse 23, it's going to say this. It says, "Be sure to know the condition of your flocks. Give careful attention to your herds." Now, just some context here. Israel, in the Old Testament, which is where we find the book of Proverbs, was an agricultural society. And at this time in history, paper money and coins did not exist. Instead, property was used as currency. And one example of this was livestock. So a key measurement of someone's wealth would be the number of livestock or the flocks and the herds that we just read about that was owned. And as you can imagine, livestock or animals, it's a really good resource, really good measure of wealth. They provided food and clothing. They could be sold, they could be traded, and they could multiply. And if you don't understand how animals multiply, that's a topic for another day. I'm not covering that this morning. And when they multiplied, someone's wealth would increase. So here, the writer of Proverbs knew that someone who managed their flocks and their herds well, so, you know, they made sure that they were fed and watered properly, they treated them for any disease or sickness, if they wandered off, they went out and found them, those managers would be more successful. They would have more wealth than someone who did not actively manage their flocks and herds. Now, most of us today don't have animals that we use as currency. We have a dog. I guarantee you she is not a source of income. She is an expense. But this idea of knowing the condition of your flocks can translate to us knowing what we have and what we're doing with what we have. And the financial term for this is budgeting. Budgeting is simply having a plan for your money. John Maxwell, he's a writer, and he says it this way. I like this. A budget is people telling their money where to go instead of wondering where it went. Now, if we truly believe that all of our money is God's and that our job is to manage it well to honor Him, then we need to be serious about having a plan. We need to be serious about budgeting. But guess what? Most of us don't budget. Back to question number one. What percent of Americans maintain a household budget? Any answers? It's B, 32%. Sorry, Zach. In Luke, in the book of Luke, Jesus uses a principle of planning about budgeting to talk about the cost of being his disciple, about being his follower. And in chapter 14, 28 to 30, Jesus says this, "But don't begin. So don't agree to be my disciple, don't agree to be my follower, until you count the cost. For who would begin construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there's enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money. And then everyone would laugh at you. They would say, there's the person who started the building and couldn't afford to finish it." Just like the builder in Jesus' story made a poor decision with his construction because he didn't calculate the cost, he didn't plan well, we are bound to make poor decisions without first making a budget. Poor decisions such as wasting money, going into debt, not planning for emergencies, not giving back to God. And I'm not going to talk about the details about how to make a budget. There's lots of stuff that goes into that, and there's a lot of resources that can walk you through that. But I will say that I believe your overall plan should be this. Give to God and others' needs first. We're going to call that share. Give to yourself second. We're going to call that save. And give to everything else last. We're going to call that spend. Share, save, spend. And we're going to delve into each of these in just a few moments. But that needs to be your basic outline. Now, starting a budget isn't ever easy. It's going to take a lot of time and effort on your part. But it's an important part to managing God's money well. And certainly don't feel ashamed to reach out for advice if you need guidance, if you need help in making your budget or in making your financial plans. If you reach out, I would just encourage you to reach out to another Christ follower who understands the why, that God owns it, that we manage it, so that we can honor Him. And if you're married, or when you get married, if you get married, please know this. It is absolutely, positively critical that your spouse is a major part of your budgeting and financial planning process. You need to work on this together. It should never be my money, your money. It should always be our money. It should never be your account or my debt. It's our account. It's our debt. Because in marriage, we're called to be a team in all aspects of our relationship, and money is no exception. And these discussions about money will probably lead to some disagreements and arguments, and that's totally okay. We're different people. We have different perspectives on things. But together, you need to get on the same page. You need to ask God to guide you as a couple on how to be the best managers of His money. So, because God owns it, and He's given it to us to use wisely in ways that honor Him, we need to work hard to manage His money well. And we start by strategizing. Now, after we have a strategy, the next step in rethinking money is setting aside money to share. And by share, I'm referring to the money that we give to God and that we give to others. Now, if we go back to the why, that idea that God owns it all, then sharing is simply returning to God a portion of what's already His. The writer of Proverbs says this in chapter 3, verse 9. "Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the best part of everything you produce." The Hebrew word here for honor is kabed, and it means to reward handsomely. And so the proverb is basically saying, reward the Lord handsomely with your wealth. Now, in hearing this proverb, the Jewish people would likely have been reminded about the concept of the tithe. And the word tithe literally means tenth. So on a dollar, on 100 cents, the tithe would have been 10 cents. And it's a good thing Sean wasn't here this morning. That would have taken way longer to calculate, okay? Love you, Sean. Anyway, now the concept of the tithe existed in other ancient cultures, in Egypt, in Babylon. And there it was given as a tribute or a gift to the king or to the country's leader. But in Israel, it wasn't about giving to a political leader. It was a portion that was given back to God. And we see it first mentioned way back in Genesis 14, when Abram returned victorious from battle. And he gave Melchizedek, who was called a priest of God Most High. Abraham gave him a tenth, or a tithe, of all the goods that had been recovered during the battle. And by giving this to Melchizedek, to the priest, Abraham was recognizing God as the one who had provided victory over Israel's enemies. Abraham was honoring God with a tithe. The Jewish people would also remember back to Moses, because Moses gave their ancestors instructions about giving a portion of their wealth back to God. In fact, they were to give to God the first and the best of all of their animals and all of their crops. Remember, we're talking about a farming society here. They weren't to give him their leftovers. They weren't to give him their extras. They weren't to give him their defects. Their gifts to God were to be the first and the best. And Moses' instructions had also reinforced the tithe. That tithe would be used to care for the tabernacle. That was where the people worshipped. It would care for the Levites. Those are the people that served in the tabernacle. And it would be used to help the poor. So the tithe and the giving back the first and the best to God helped to remind the Israelite people that what they had wasn't theirs. It was God's. It was a way for them to show that He, that God, was the most important thing in their lives, and that they were committed to honoring Him with everything that they had. The tithe was a part of the covenant, the contract between God and the people of Israel. And as we learned in our recent series, this covenant, this contract, was what's called conditional. Meaning, if the people of Israel obeyed, in this case, if they gave to God, if they tithed, then God, in turn, would bless them. Now, for us as Christ followers who aren't Jewish, we're no longer under this covenant. That means that the tithe is no longer a requirement for us to please God. Our faith isn't based on rules, like in the covenant, but rather on relationship, on knowing Jesus. Maybe that explains the answer to the second trivia question from earlier. What percentage of American churchgoers give 10% of their income to their church? It's A, 5%. That's a really low number. In fact, churchgoers today give a lower percentage of their income than they did during the Great Depression. Now, these numbers suggest that most of us don't believe that it's important to give 10% back to God. After all, we might think, hey, we're not Jewish. It's no longer something we have to do. But let me tell you this. I feel that the ideal that we are called to as Christ followers is actually much greater. And why do I think this? Well, it's because what I read in Mark. And in Mark 12, we read this. It says, Jesus sat down near the collection box in the temple and watched as the crowds dropped in their money. Many rich people put in large amounts. It was likely their tithe because they were under the law. But then a poor widow came and dropped in two small coins. Jesus called his disciples, his followers, over to him, and he said, I tell you the truth, this poor widow has given more than all the others who are making contributions. For they gave a tiny part of their surplus, but she, poor as she is, had given everything she had to live on. That poor widow gave everything she had to live on, and I'm pretty sure everything is more than 10%. So where does that leave us? Well, I believe that the tithe, even though it's not commanded to us, I think it's a good starting point for our giving. And I believe it really has to be the first and the best, just like it was for Israel, meaning that we set it aside before we do anything else, before what we save, before what we spend. And because of this, and this one's hard, I think we should calculate our tithe based on our gross income rather than our net income, meaning not what we bring home, but we actually get paid before taxes. And I believe this because we're going to give to God even before we give to the government. And that makes the tithe hard. But remember, I said earlier, when it comes to rethinking money, it wasn't going to be easy. Giving God our first 10% helps us to acknowledge, just like it did for Israel, that it's all God's, it's not ours. It helps to remind us that we are simply managers of what we've been given, and that God, not money, is the most important thing in our lives. We cannot say that God is the most important part of our lives and then only give Him what's left over at the end of the month. Because I guarantee you, most months, it's not going to be much. Now, one of the most common reasons that people give for not tithing or not giving is, I just don't have enough money. I don't have the money. But that's only because they're not being intentional about giving. In other words, they don't prioritize it. It's not the first part of their budget, but it needs to be. And that might mean reducing other expenses in order to have money to give to God. Because if we say that we don't have money to tithe, but yet we have cable TV, and we have a nice cell phone, and we go out to the movies, and we buy Frappuccino lattes with extra cream, you know where I'm going with this, right? Because we put money into what we value. And if we give money to all those things, but not to God, then we're showing that God really isn't our priority. Those things are. TV, cell phone, lattes, but they all rank higher. And if God isn't first in our lives, then it means we aren't honoring Him with our money. Now, I said that the tithe is a good starting point. That's because we should always be looking to give more of God's money back to God. In fact, I think we should stretch ourselves with our giving. It should make us a bit uncomfortable. After all, the more money we give to God, the less money that we have for ourselves, and that's not comfortable. If we don't do this, if we choose to stay comfortable, it probably means we're holding onto our money a little bit more tightly than we should. And we risk trusting in money rather than trusting in the one who really owns it. MC3, like most churches, relies on the giving of us, all of us, to pay the expenses throughout the year. These expenses include mortgage and utilities to the building. It includes paying for Sean, the salaries of Sean and Chris and Carla and Dawn, and various needs in our community and beyond. Oaxaca is an example. This sounds real familiar with what the tithe was used for way back in ancient Israel. Remember, the tithe went for caring for the tabernacle, so the place where they worshipped. It went for providing for the people that served at the tabernacle, and it went to helping the poor. And until we as elders find that magic money tree that grows $100 bills and plant a few out back, it's going to be your giving that's going to keep our ministry functioning. Your giving shows that you support what God is doing through MC3. It helps us to reach more people for Jesus. And that's the whole point, right? Reaching people for Jesus. I believe that we should support our local church, so the body that we're a part of. We should support our local church with our presence and our purse. And you can find that in Justin 3:27. You can go look for that. Now, before we move on, the concept of sharing doesn't stop with giving to God. Even after we give that 10%, that starting point that we said, to our local church, we should be looking for ways to give to those around us, to needs around us. And maybe that involves sponsoring a kid at Oaxaca. Maybe it means buying school supplies during the CYS project, or chipping in to help someone buy a dishwasher, or giving a meal to someone who just had a baby, or buying someone a gas card because they're in a tight spot, or supporting Crossroads Pregnancy Center. I mean, the list could go on and on and on. But God loves it when we give generously with what He's provided for us to manage. And in the Message translation of the Bible says it this way. I like this. In 2 Corinthians, it says, God loves it when the giver delights in the giving. Because God knows that giving helps us to keep that healthy money perspective, that He owns it, that we manage it. But God also knows that it brings us tremendous joy to help meet the needs of those around us, to be involved in that process, to be involved in what He's doing. It's all God's. We need to share it back to God and then share it to others. And we need to continually seek ways to do this more and more and more. As someone once said, and it's not Winston Churchill, that's been debunked, but someone said, we make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. And that is especially true for us as Christ followers. Now, moving on. The next part of rethinking money as we look at the book of Proverbs is to save. So, after we designate a portion for God and others, that's the sharing, we need to set aside, we need to save a portion for ourselves. Well, why should we do that? Well, if we're being good managers of God's money, then we want to make sure we are planning for future expenses, for future needs. In Proverbs 6:6-8, the writer says this. It says, take a lesson from the ants, you lazy bones. Funny expression. Learn from their ways and become wise. Though they have no prince or governor or ruler to make them work, they labor hard all summer, gathering food for the winter. So here's another reference to agriculture. Because the Jewish people hearing this proverb understood the idea of working hard to grow the food that they needed. Remember, they were farmers. They also understood that after the harvest, there would be a season that would come when crops wouldn't grow, winter. And in Pennsylvania, you don't see fields of corn growing in January. The people knew that if they didn't plan properly, if they didn't set aside or save a portion of what they were harvesting, like the ants did, then they wouldn't have enough food to last them through the winter. And for us, that doesn't mean a whole lot. In winter, we go to the grocery store, we buy more. But in ancient Israel, running out of food could mean starvation. Now, winter was expected. But the people hearing this proverb also knew that they could face some unexpected events. They knew that there would be things like disease and drought and insects that could negatively affect their crops, that could affect the harvest. And in those times, just like for winter, having extra crops set aside or saved could be a matter of life and death. Now, for us, saving money probably isn't a matter of life and death, but it's still an important part of managing God's money. Because when expected and unexpected needs arise for us, whether that's for ourselves or for those around us, we really need to be able to meet those needs without going into debt to do so. And we're going to talk about debt in just a few minutes. Today, we can expect that there's going to be certain expenses every year. So we need to plan for them. We need to save for them. Maybe it's taxes. I mean, every year. Income tax, property tax, school tax. It's one of the only guarantees in life, right? Death and taxes. Or maybe it's insurance. Maybe you're talking auto, homeowners, renters, life. These are all expenses that happen usually once or twice a year that we should be setting money aside for, just like the ants did for winter. Now, if you think a little more long-term, we should all be saving towards retirement. Unless you plan to work until the day that you die, I do not, you can expect to need money to live on when you're older. You know, it used to be that workers would count on their pension plan or their retirement plan from their employer. Or maybe you count on Social Security from the government. But those things aren't guaranteed anymore. Pension plans aren't as generous as they used to be, if they exist at all. Social Security is projected to run out of money in 2034. So we should expect to need money for retirement. There are also some unexpected expenses that we should be saving to meet. We all know that life has a funny way of throwing financial curveballs our way. Whether you're talking about unexpected medical bills, auto repairs, appliances that you have to replace, the list goes on and on and on. And if you own your home, you know exactly what I'm talking about. This was the biggest adjustment, I think, for us when we went from renting to owning, just the amount of unexpected expenses that we were going to run into. And I think we would all agree, if we were honest, that we think saving is important. The problem is, we're really bad at it. We're lousy savers. Back to our trivia. What percentage of Americans have less than $1,000 in their bank accounts? What do you think, Levi? D. 70% have less than $1,000. Some more startling facts. This is crazy. 39% of Americans don't have enough cash on hand to cover a $400 emergency. 40% of Americans have less than $10,000 saved for retirement. And I hate to break it to you, but $10,000 isn't going to get you very far in retirement. Why are we lousy savers? Well, because we're avid spenders. Instead of setting aside money for God by sharing and then ourselves by saving, we spend first. And we only look to share and to save if we have money left over. We need to get into the habit of designating money to God in our savings before anything else. And Paul wrote a little bit about this concept in 1 Corinthians 16. In 1 and 2, he says this, and he's writing to the church in Corinth. He says, "Now, regarding your question about the money being collected for God's people in Jerusalem, you should follow the same procedure I gave to the churches in Galatia. On the first day of each week, you should put aside a portion of the money you have earned. Don't wait until I get there and try to collect it all at once." In other words, be disciplined enough to set money aside for needs that you know you're going to have rather than trying to scramble at the last second. Many of you have probably heard of Dave Ramsey. He's one of the key financial personalities of our time. He is a Christ follower. He's also one of the resources that I'm going to reference here at the end. But part of his teaching, one of the big parts of his teaching, is that everyone should have a $1,000 emergency fund. Now, he also advocates that everyone should save at least 3 months' worth of expenses. And that seems a bit crazy. But one of the biggest financial regrets that people have had during the last couple of years with COVID was not having money set aside to help when they lost their jobs, when they had their hours cut, when they had to be out sick. And while we hope that we never see something like that again in our lifetime, there's certainly no guarantees. And if we think a little more long-term, advisors recommend that we save at least 10% for retirement. And here's where that overwhelming comes from. But remember, it's all God's. Our goal is to manage it well. And part of that managing it is planning for the future. Our next part of rethinking money. It's one that we're really good at. Really, really good at. I mean, we might not be good at sharing. We might not be good at saving. But we are all really good at spending. And by good, I mean that we do it a lot, not that we do it the right way. Because if we believe that God owns it all, and that we are managing His money for Him, then that means we should be wise when it comes to spending His money. It would be really easy for us to think that after we take that 10% and share, and then we take that 10% and save, that we can just spend the remaining 80% however we please. But I'm here to tell you that we really need to honor God with our spending. We need to make sure that our spending is God-pleasing and not self-serving. And a quick test of this is just look at our checkbooks, look to see where our money is going. We spend money on what's important to us. And in Proverbs, one of the verses that speaks to this is Proverbs 21:17. It says, "Those who love pleasure become poor. Those who love wine and luxury will never be rich." The Old Testament Jewish farmers that would hear this would be relying on the crops and the animals that they raised to provide for their families. They were subsistence farmers for the most part. That means there wouldn't be a whole lot left over after the family used what they needed. So they had to be really careful on how they used their resources. They had to manage them well. And the Hebrew word for love used here in this proverb gives us a little better understanding of what the writer's talking about. The word used here is Ahab. It translates to a human appetite for stuff. Greed for material things, and it suggests a lack of self-control. So according to this proverb, those who Ahab pleasure, those who Ahab luxury, in other words, those who spend their resources unwisely because they're greedy, because they lack self-control, they risk ending up poor. And for these Jewish farmers, if they spent unwisely, if they ended up poor, then they and their family could be in serious trouble. The key to managing God's money well with our spending is having an attitude that pursues God rather than an attitude that pursues material things. We say that in a different way. Our spending needs to be influenced by Christ, not influenced by culture. Hands down, our American culture is driven by consumerism. I think we'd all agree with that. Things like, I want more, which is greed. I want new, which is discontent. And I want now, which is impulse buying. And it's really difficult for us to stay focused on spending in a God-honoring way when we're bombarded by the message everywhere we go that entices us to pursue more or pursue it better or pursue it now. Yet Jesus said this in Luke 12:15. He says, "Beware, guard against every kind of greed, because life is not measured by how much you own." Now, there's no sin in having money. There's no sin in buying nice things. Just because someone has a large house or a newer car or a fifth-wheel camper or a gun collection, it doesn't mean that they spend their money unwisely or in a way that dishonors God. Because if we've budgeted for it, and we've already given to God through sharing, and we've already given to ourselves by saving, then we can feel free to have a little bit of fun with our money. We just always have to be careful. Because if our main goal, if that thing that drives us is just to keep buying more things or bigger things or better things, then we're failing as our job as stewards. And I can tell you, most of us are failing. If we look at our fourth question, what percentage of Americans say that they've wasted a considerable amount of money in their lifetimes? The answer is C, 64%. We're narrowing them down here just to let you know. C, 64%. Whether it's buying overpriced items, not comparison shopping, wasting food, updating something to the newest model even though it was still working, we admit that we waste a lot of money. Why does it matter? Well, it matters because we are wasting someone else's money. Remember, it's not ours, it's God's. We are wasting God's money. Our goal when managing God's money should be to use more of it on things that please Him. And we do this by increasing our sharing back to God, back to others. And we increase our sharing. To do that, we need to decrease our spending. More to God and others, less to us. So how do we decrease our spending? Well, I think we can start by taking a stance against greed and against discontentment and against impulse buying. Greed, wanting more. We are really quick to see the things that those around us have that we do not. We want to keep up with the Joneses next door, or Mifflin County, keep up with the Yoders next door. No offense, Kristen, okay? We want another pair of shoes, or we want, you know, the new video game. We want a boat, a gun, a truck, whatever you can think of. Fill in the blank. And as soon as we get that thing, whatever that thing is, we probably want something else. But if we are rethinking money, then we need to distinguish between needs and wants. Needs are necessary. Wants are optional. If your refrigerator dies, that's a need. You need something to keep your stuff cool so it doesn't spoil. If your kid outgrows their clothes, that's a need. They can't be running naked through the streets. It's not good. But buying that new Marvel movie once it comes out on Blu-ray, we might think we need that, but that's a want. And it's okay to spend money on our wants at times. We just have to monitor it closely. If we don't, we risk wasting God's money. Discontent, so that's wanting new. As Americans, we're very wasteful. Instead of repairing or reusing or recycling or repurposing, we throw it out and we buy new. Instead of using something until it breaks, we throw it out and get another one. My grandmother lived through the Great Depression, and she learned out of necessity the importance of being content and not wasteful. Till the day she died, she kept almost all of her plastic food containers. She reused Cool Whip and mayo jars and ice cream buckets. We still have some of them today. She dried paper towels if they weren't too dirty. She wore her clothes until they couldn't be mended any longer. Now, should we be that extreme? Probably not. But by being more content and less wasteful, we will spend less money. That 55-inch TV that we have, it's probably okay. We don't need to upgrade to an 85-inch. That new iPhone 99 or whatever they are on at this point isn't much different than the 98 that you already have. Let's work on being content with God, with what God has already provided to us, so that we spend less on ourselves. And then last, impulse buying. That's wanting it now. Impulse buying is purchasing something without any kind of advanced planning. In other words, it's buying things in the spur of the moment. And it's usually driven by our emotions or our feelings. And stores are really good at this. You go to the grocery store, you're in the checkout line, that's where they put the candy bars. And you didn't really plan on buying a Snickers, but you are kind of hungry. You know that Snickers satisfies, so you buy one. It's how you end up when you're at the clothing store. You buy a few shirts and a couple pairs of shorts because they're having a 50% off sale. It ends today, even though you walked in just to buy a belt. It's why, you know, when you end up with a new cell phone with all the new bells and whistles, when all you did was you were trying to stop in the store just to ask a question about your plan. Studies have shown, and this is a crazy statistic, studies have shown that between 40 and 80% of all of our purchases are impulse buys. When we don't take the time to carefully consider our options, we're more likely to make poor decisions that don't manage God's money well. Now, Warren Buffett, I think we all know who he is. He's considered to be a pretty good manager of money, and he has quite a bit. Last time, right around $80 billion. That's with a B. Yet, he lives in the same house that he bought in 1958 for $31,500. He drives a 2014 Cadillac XTS. I don't know what that is, Bill, but whatever it is. It's 2014. He's been known to use coupons when he goes to McDonald's. So here's a man that could have any material possession that his heart desires, and yet it doesn't seem that he falls into the trap of greed or discontent or impulse buying. Now, Steph and I are no Warren Buffett by any stretch of the imagination, but we do own some nice things. And over the years, we have followed a few kind of unwritten rules when it comes to our spending. I'll share a couple of them with you. We research before we buy. And the more expensive the item is, the more research we do. We're going to look at customer ratings. We're going to compare brands. We're going to watch for quite a while to find the best pricing. And because of this, we rarely make quick buying decisions. We do often buy a little better quality, but that's because we have found that better quality typically lasts longer. And so it's more cost-effective over time. We save for things that we want that aren't necessarily needs, that they're wants. We save for those things by having a separate account for them. And then we pour into their birthday money or Christmas money, or if we resell something, kind of goes into that special account that we can use for some of our wants. We brew our coffee at home. I pack my lunch for work. Whenever football season's over, we actually reduce our cable plan. We buy off-brand food or name brands on sale because you can't have generic Pepsi. You just can't, right? And we use coupons when we can. These are all just simple ways that we feel that we can manage God's money well, that we can reduce our spending. And there's lots and lots of other things I'm sure that you can think of. In my first year of optometry school, we had a professor. And this professor was encouraging us to manage our money well while we were students, to avoid going into more debt than necessary. Optometry school is very expensive. He wanted to help us just not go too far into debt, so we should spend wisely. One of my classmates did not listen to him. He went out and bought a racehorse with his loan money. That was not the best use of the money. But anyway, this is what my professor said. He said, and I didn't know at the time, but this is actually something that comes from Dave Ramsey as well. He said, live now like no one else will. Meaning, hey, live simple, cut your costs, be frugal. So live now like no one else will, so you can live later like no one else can. And as Christ followers, I think we can adjust that a little bit. And we can say it this way. Live now like no one else will, so that you can live, so that you can give later like no one else can. Because it should be more to God and less to us. Now, up until now, our discussion has revolved around how to rethink money about actions that we should do. So we should make a budget. We should share our money. We should save our money. And we should spend our money wisely. But before we end for the morning, I want to talk about something that we shouldn't do, if at all possible. And that is to go into debt or see the bank. Got to keep the S's all in line. You know, Sean would be proud of that, right? So now the writers of the Bible didn't forbid borrowing, but they did discourage it. Whenever they discussed debt or borrowing, they usually talked about it as a negative, with warnings about its danger and its misuse. And that's what we see when the writer of Proverbs says this in chapter 22, verse 7. Just as the rich rule the poor, so the borrower is servant to the lender. Let me give you a little bit of that history here. In the ancient world, people often got wealthy at the expense of other people. Remember, most people were farmers. Land was one of their primary assets. And some people had more assets than others. They had more resources. They were the ones that were considered rich. So if you had someone who was poorer, if they found themselves in a situation where they needed money, they needed something, they couldn't just go to a bank and borrow it. Banks didn't exist back then. So instead, they would borrow from someone who was rich. And they would often put whatever land that they had up as collateral. Now, unfortunately, the terms of these loans usually weren't real favorable. And if that poor person would default, in other words, if they couldn't pay that loan back, then the rich person would keep the collateral. They would keep the poor person's land. So the rich person rules over the poor, just like the proverb said. Now, it was a little different for the Israelites. God wanted his people to stand out from all the other countries around them, all the other nations around them. So Jewish law said that the rich were not to take advantage of someone who borrowed from them. In fact, interest couldn't be charged to the poor when they needed to borrow money. Now, the borrower was still expected to pay back the loan, but one way he could do that was with his labor. So he could become a servant to the person who had loaned him the money. And he would continue on as a servant. He would continue working off that loan until it was paid in full. Therefore, the borrower is servant to the lender. Now, taking on debt or borrowing in Israel was really considered a last resort. It was really only acceptable for someone who was poor, who didn't have any other alternative. But today, debt is considered a very normal part of our society, and some people consider it part of their financial plan. Whether you're talking about credit card debt, mortgage, student loans, business loans, most Americans have some level of debt. In fact, going back to our last trivia question, what percent of American households are in debt? E, 77%. More startling facts, because I'll just throw these out there. The average American debt per adult, $58,604. The total debt of all Americans together, $14.96 trillion. Until debt is repaid, the borrower, you, me, we're servant to the institution. We're servant to the lender that made the loan, meaning that we have an obligation to fulfill. We owe them. Why should that bother us? Well, because it means that someone else is telling us what to do with God's money. The money that God entrusted us to manage, someone else is in charge of. The lender is telling us how much we have to pay every month. The lender is telling us what the interest rate's going to be. And it should also bother us because the more money we have tied up with paying back our loans, the less money we have to share with God and others. in Romans, we see Paul give a warning about debt. And he says this in 13:8. He says, "Owe nothing to anyone except for your obligation to love one another." Love debt? Good. All other debt? Bad. Joey Tribbiani. Did you catch that? Did you? Good. Some of you don't know who that is, but... So, what are some practical ways of rethinking money when it comes to debt? First off, if you are in debt, which most of us probably are, work to get out. Easier said than done, I know. But we need to work to free up more of God's money. Your creditors, your lenders, are usually willing to negotiate more favorable terms. They'd rather you pay them something than to go bankrupt and not pay them at all. Dave Ramsey advocates something called the debt snowball method, where you work with your lowest loan first, your smallest loan first, and pay that off and then kind of keep working your way up. And while you're paying off your debt, don't accrue more debt. Don't take out new loans. Stop using your credit card. Pay cash. Now, most of us probably can't get a house or go to college or run a business without borrowing some amount of money. And Dave Ramsey probably would disagree with this, but that's okay. But what do we do then? Well, I think there are some guidelines that we can do debt better. Here they are. First, I think we do try to avoid borrowing unless it's absolutely necessary. Don't make it a way of life. Make it the exception to the rule. In other words, you may need to borrow to buy your house, but don't borrow just to replace your furniture. Also, be sure to get the best possible terms that you can. That means getting the shortest duration, get the lowest interest rate, and then, when you have that, work to pay off that loan as quickly as you can. Now, I just want to give you a real special note, a quick detour here about credit card debt. Despite what some people teach, I believe that credit cards aren't inherently good or evil. They're simply a form of currency. The problem with credit cards is that it takes more self-control to use them wisely. And it's very easy to let our greed and our impatience influence our spending because all we have to do is swipe or insert it or tap it, and voila, the thing is ours. And if we aren't careful, we quickly lose track of the money that we're spending. And that means sticker shock when the next statement arrives, and then we can't pay it. And this is why in 2020 alone, credit card companies made $76 billion off of our interest. They made another $25 billion in fees and penalties. So if you choose to use a credit card, keep really good track of what you're charging. And be sure to pay off the balance every month to avoid those fees, to avoid that interest. And lastly, when it comes to debt, don't let borrowing be your number one plan for emergencies. As we already discussed, we need to have some money saved up for times such as this. But we also shouldn't rush into debt in times of emergencies because we need to give God the opportunity to provide for us. In times of urgent need, one of our greatest resources is the body of Christ. It's each other. If we're truly being the church, then we're going to help each other. We're going to share our resources with each other when these opportunities arise. And there's a lot of people in this room who have experienced God's provision through other people. And if we rush into debt in times of emergency, not only are we going to worsen our financial situation, but we risk missing out on God's working through those around us. As we wrap up this morning, know this. God doesn't need our money. It's already His. But He does want our money. Because when we're willing to surrender our money to Him, to really let go of it, because we know that it's all His, we acknowledge that He's the top priority in our lives. And then we can see Him provide for us and use us to provide for others. And when that happens, our faith is going to grow stronger. And our perspective begins to change. And we begin to value what God values rather than what the world considers to be valuable. And when we value what God values, we're going to want to share more of it with Him, more of it with God, and more of it with others. And it's going to become easier for us to save for the future because we're going to spend less money on things that don't have eternal significance. So remember, God owns it, we manage it, so it can honor Him. Now, before we pray, just real quick, this one last slide. Go two forward there for me. These are some of the resources that I have found helpful over the years with finances. Crown.org, they have something on the radio called My Money Life, but they have lots and lots of blog posts on their website. Great resource about all things money. Ramsey Solutions is Dave Ramsey's site. Lots of books, lots of resources, some paid, some not, or great resources though. YouVersion, so the Bible plan that most of us have, They have tons of different plans about money. Just type money into the search engine. One's by Craig Rochelle, one's by Andy Stanley, and a whole host of others. And then lastly, Quicken.com, of course not a Christian site per se. This is just a financial tool that I've used for many, many years for budgeting and for tracking expenses. It is a paid version, but like I said, there's lots of free stuff out there. All you have to do is look. Okay? So hopefully you can use some of the resources if that's something that interests you. So let's close this morning with some prayer. Hey, God, we thank you so much just for the opportunity to be used by you. We know that money is a difficult topic. We know it makes us uncomfortable. And we know there's tons of stuff in the scriptures that relate to money, and we only scratched the surface this morning. But we do ask that you would help us to be the best possible managers of the resources that you've given to us. Help us to share and to save and to spend in ways that honor you. Challenge us in that. Help us to find ways that bit by bit we can change our habits, that we can change our mindsets, so that we can bring glory to you. Thank you for the opportunity that we can be involved in what you're doing here on earth. It's in your name. Amen.